Energy.
Good morning. It's Tuesday, August 28th, 2018. This is Up Front. I'm Brian Edwards-Tiegert.
And I'm Antonia Yuhas. Yesterday, President Trump announced a preliminary agreement with the government of Mexico to renegotiate NAFTA. Left out of the preliminary agreement is the government of Canada, but that seems to be just the beginnings. We'll see. We are going to dig deep into what this means, what the agreement is, where it's going, with Lori Wallach, director and founder of Public Citizens Global Trade Watch, and Laura Carlson, director of the Americas Program of the Center for International Policy.
Then a deep dive on anti-trade sentiment and other forms of populism with Barry Eichengreen, who's just done a history of populism, populist movements and the economic circumstances that give rise to them and determine whether they succeed or fail. We'll discuss his book. And in our second hour, a deep dive on water politics in California, where the federal government has just given local authorities in the Delta that they want a reopener on an agreement that has been governing water use there for the last 32 years. All that and a lot more coming up next.
After the news.
I'm Max Springle with these headlines. The UN's top human rights body says the governments of Yemen, the United Arab Emirates, and Saudi Arabia may have been responsible for war crimes, including rape, torture, and disappearances during 3.5 years of escalated fighting against rebels in Yemen. In their first report for the Human Rights Council, UN experts also point to possible crimes by rebel Shiite Houthi militia in Yemen, who've been fighting a Saudi-led coalition and Yemen's government in a civil war since March 2015. The experts have also chronicled the damages from coalition airstrikes, the single most lethal force in the fighting over the last year. UN expert Charles Garraway.
Individuals in the government of Yemen and the coalition, including Saudi Arabia and the United Arab Emirates, may have conducted attacks in violation of the principles of distinction, proportionality, and/or precautions, which may amount to war crimes.
The UN urged the international community to refrain from providing arms that could be used in the conflict. It's an apparent reference to countries including the United States and Britain that help arm the Saudi-led coalition, as well as Iran, which the coalition is accused of arming the Houthis. The experts visited some, but not all, parts of Yemen as they compiled the report. Important primaries are being held today in Arizona and Florida. In Arizona, Republicans are running for the seat of retiring Senator Jeff Flake. Flake has been a vocal Trump critic, which could play a role as the state's GOP moves further to the right toward Trump and away from Flake and the late John McCain. The outcome of Tuesday's primary will be closely watched by Arizona Governor Doug Ducey. He must name a replacement to fill John McCain's seat for the next 2 years. McCain died Saturday after a year-long battle with brain cancer. Florida is also holding a primary today, while voters in Oklahoma participate in a runoff for governor. Florida voters are going to the polls to select nominees to replace Republican Governor Rick Scott. President Trump endorsed U.S. Representative Ron DeSantis in the Republican primary for governor over Agriculture Commissioner Adam Putnam. Former Democratic U.S. Representative Gwen Graham is trying to fend off 4 challengers as she seeks to become Florida's first woman governor and to take the seat her father, Bob Graham, held in the 70s and 80s. President Trump's declaration of victory Monday in reaching a preliminary deal with Mexico to replace the North American Free Trade Agreement raised at least as many questions as it answered. A deal with Canada remains in the offing. Canadian Foreign Minister Chrystia Freeland will be in Washington today for negotiations. It may not be legal for Trump to reach a replacement trade deal with Mexico without including Canada. Trump campaigned on an anti-NAFTA platform and disparaged the treaty Monday at the White House.
We'll get rid of the name NAFTA. It has a bad connotation because the United States was hurt very badly by NAFTA for many years, and now it's a really good deal for both countries.
Trump suggested that he might leave Canada out of a new agreement. He said he wanted to call the revamped trade pact the United States-Mexico Trade Agreement because, in his view, NAFTA has earned a reputation for being harmful to U.S. workers. But first, he said he would give Canada a chance to get back in. To intensify the pressure on Ottawa to agree to his terms, the president threatened to impose new taxes on Canadian auto imports. China is challenging the latest round of U.S. tariffs against Chinese goods through the World Trade Organization. The Chinese government on Monday formally requested dispute consultations with the United States over the Trump administration's imposition of $16 billion in tariffs on Chinese goods last week. China has responded with similar taxes on American goods. Its request to the World Trade Organization opens a 60-day period for the two countries to hold talks. Los Angeles County health officials say they're continuing to detect evidence of West Nile virus in the region. Officials say 19 mosquitoes have tested positive for West Nile in the past few weeks. KPFK's Ernesto Arce reports.
The Greater Los Angeles County Vector Control District reported that the positive samples were collected in Burbank, Encino, La Mirada, Montebello, Northridge, Panorama City, Porter Ranch, Sherman Oaks, Sun Valley, and Van Nuys, in the period between July 3rd and August 16th. West Nile virus is transmitted to people and animals through the bite of an infected mosquito and is a leading cause of severe infections of the nervous system among adults over 50 in Los Angeles County. There is no current cure for West Nile virus. A total of 10 cases of the West Nile virus have been reported by the LA County Department of Public Health so far this year, with 70% of the patients requiring hospitalization. Residents are encouraged to make sure that water-holding containers on private property are emptied to prevent mosquito reproduction. The district also recommends residents use Environmental Protection Agency registered repellents, including DEET, picaridin, IR3535, and oil of lemon eucalyptus to prevent bites and West Nile virus. In Los Angeles, I'm Ernesto Arce, Pacifica Radio, KPFK.
Debate over legislation to prevent California wildfires and allow utilities to pass along costs to ratepayers is going down to the final hours of the legislative session. A California Legislative Conference Committee met late Monday but fell short of an agreement. Lawmakers must finalize the bill today in order to vote on it ahead of the legislature's constitutional deadline on Friday. The panel has debated for weeks whether to shield utilities from liability when their equipment causes wildfires and how much of those costs can be passed along to customers. Lawmakers rejected changing the liability rules for utilities, but they have proposed allowing power companies to sell bonds to pay off wildfire-related debts and pass along the costs as a surcharge on utility bills. The East Bay Times reports that the Alameda County District Attorney took more than a decade to investigate a police officer's fatal shooting of an unarmed man. The paper reported Monday that Alameda County District Attorney Nancy O'Malley acknowledged her office failed to finalize its investigation of the December 2007 shooting in Oakland and notify the city's police department of its conclusions. The district attorney's policy is to investigate and report the results of every fatal police shooting in its jurisdiction. The DA's office said investigators completed the report in 2013 but failed to send the results to the police department. Partly cloudy today in the San Francisco Bay Area, highs in the 60s and 70s, overnight lows in the 50s. In the central San Joaquin Valley, clear with highs around 90, lows tonight in the 60s. I'm Max Pringle. News returns at 7:30 on KPFA.
Just past 7:08 in the morning, you're listening to Upfront. I'm Brian Edwards-Tiekert.
And I'm Antonia Yuhas. Yesterday in the White House, President Trump announced the signing of a preliminary agreement to renegotiate NAFTA with Mexico. The deal was signed with outgoing president of Mexico, Peña Nieto, and with the current president of the United States, Donald Trump. In the photograph that accompanies the announcement, we have Donald Trump flanked by Jared Kushner. We have the U.S. Trade Representative, Robert Lighthizer. We have Michael Pence, and we have John Bolton. That lineup of folks might lead some people to have some concerns about what this preliminary agreement might include. The agreement also doesn't include one of the key partners, Canada. To go through all these details with us and help us understand what's there, what isn't, and what needs to be, we are joined by Lori Wallach, Director and Founder of Public Citizens Global Trade Watch. Thanks for joining us, Lori.
Thank you.
And also,
good morning.
And also Laura Carlson. She's director of the Americas Program of the Center for International Policy. Thanks for being with us, Laura. All right, we're going to keep working on Laura. Laura, are you there?
Yes, can you hear me?
Yes, we can. Thank you for being with us as well. Lori, we are going to start with you. Can you tell us what happened yesterday?
Well, there was an announcement on a preliminary deal in the NAFTA renegotiations that started a year ago. This is a deal with the U.S. and Mexico. Canada has been largely sitting out the process since May. In May, Canada basically said it just simply refused to engage on one particular provision that the U.S. insisted on, which is a sunset. It's a provision that instead of having the agreement go on forever, like the current NAFTA does or the TPP does, would set a specific term and require the countries to reauthorize it. Canada just found that totally objectionable. The U.S. and Mexico kept talking, and while they have made some big progress on some longstanding progressive demands, they have whacked the investor-state dispute settlement part of the corporate tribunals out of the agreement, and they have gotten rid of the outrageous natural resources mandatory corporate access rules that Canada hated especially, that guaranteed rights to water, oil, gas, timber for multinational companies in the NAFTA countries. They put in a rather stunning $16 an hour minimum wage for a certain portion of automobiles made under NAFTA, and they put in some very strong labor standards, but the labor standards part still does not have proper enforcement. It's pretty important stuff, but it doesn't matter if it's not enforceable. Plus, who knows what other things may be lurking in there we don't know about that could be a problem. There's some worrisome things in access to medicines and intellectual property rules. But also, it's a work in progress because Canada's not there and NAFTA is a three-country agreement. So there is a question about whether Canada will agree to the things that the U.S. and Mexico agreed to. And all of this is going to come to a head by Friday because that's the deadline for notice to Congress under fast track on a deal.
So the time pressure was, and this was a process that Trump began a year ago, saying that he wanted to either trash NAFTA or renegotiate NAFTA. And there is a deadline, which is by Friday, something has to be introduced to the U.S. Congress, to the Mexican, in the Mexican government. What's the Friday deadline?
So by Friday, notice has to be conveyed to Congress of what is called intent to enter into and sign the agreement. And it's a 90-day notice requirement under the fast-track trade procedures. And that the urgency about that is that the administration spent a year negotiating an agreement and now has this deal with the Mexican government that transitions out on December 1st. So the deadline is basically the last day that the Mexican government that has agreed to these terms can sign the agreement is November 30th, which makes this Friday the 90 days ahead of when the notice has to happen to be able to sign the agreement with the government that's negotiated the agreement before the new Mexican government comes in. Now, the new incoming Mexican government, the AMLO, the populist government, has been at the table, basically over the shoulder of the outgoing government, approving everything for the last couple of months. But it is a very different piece of politics if AMLO himself is supposed to be the person signing the deal versus the guy who can live with what the other president's signing. So that's the sort of sense of urgency.
Well, that's what I'm wondering, is who's been at the table over this over the last year? Because like I said, this photograph of the announcement, Kushner, Bolton, Pence, Trump, you know, that's a worrisome lineup of men to be the ones featured as, you know, who we need to understand is behind this agreement from the Trump side. You know, have you been at the table? Has labor, have environmental groups, have immigrant, human rights groups, you know, all those, both in Mexico and in the United States? Or has this been a closed-door process and you're basically seeing a window into it now?
So I would recommend at this point everyone put down their hot coffee mugs just so no one spills, because this is going to be a shocker. Everyone's going to either spit out coffee or dump their coffee. But the reality is, and it's not what you'd expect, and it's heartbreaking, but actually with respect to, say, labor or a group like Public Citizen, we've had a lot bigger say on these negotiations than, for instance, we did on the Trans-Pacific Partnership. And as a result, some of those things I've mentioned, the ISDS, you know, being the ISDS chapter being undone, the Business Roundtable is on the warpath today, the Wall Street Journal editorial page is on the warpath about that today.
We need to translate, Lori. That's the investor state dispute system. It's what lets companies sue to overturn regulations. Is that right?
Yes. Yes, exactly. I'm sorry. That's what I was talking about, is those tribunals I was talking about where corporations can attack our environmental and health laws. $492 million have been paid out in the first 25 years of NAFTA in corporate attacks on land use, environmental, timber, water, toxic ban policies, court rulings, or energy policies, and the system empowers multinational corporations to skirt domestic courts and sue governments in front of tribunals of three corporate attorneys who are allowed to order governments, taxpayers, to pay unlimited damages to the corporations over claims that the corporation's special NAFTA rights to be free of regulation, et cetera, have been violated. And it's been one of the worst parts of NAFTA, for sure. And that that provision coming out is something that the corporate lobby is very upset about. But the reason why, for instance, that change is in the deal, or there's been a big push on the wage levels and the labor standards, is because the guy who's the trade representative is someone who actually, despite the whole rogues gallery you just described, which makes my blood run cold, the one guy in there, Robert Lighthizer, the trade representative, who is one of the guys in that picture, he's a guy who, since the original NAFTA, has opposed the investor state dispute settlement system, has thought the Buy Local, Buy America ban was a bad idea, has thought we needed labor standards to stop the race to the bottom. He's kind of an iconoclastic guy, and he happens to be friends with a lot of unions and with a lot of Democrats in Congress, because most Republicans do not agree with him. And with this U.S.-Mexico deal, you can see quite a bit of his handiwork. Now, it's not done until it's done. So could the rest of that rogues gallery end up pushing back on what he's achieved? Could the final deal not measure up? Well, we know already the enforcement doesn't measure up. Who knows what other things might be in there? But I do think it's really important for progressives, as much as we have a very well-founded instinctive revulsion for almost anything this administration might say or do, it is worth actually waiting to see what the actual text has. Because the things we know that are in this meta deal with the U.S. and Mexico, a bunch of them, again, big caveat, if the labor enforcement comes through, could actually help stop what is very severe ongoing damage that NAFTA is causing every week. Mm-hmm. More jobs are being outsourced because people in Mexico haven't the right to have independent unions or contracts.
Well, let me.
In this agreement is an annex that would actually require those Mexican protection unions be disbanded, and that there be actual secret ballot votes by the workers on unions and contracts. And all those old protection fake contracts would have to be replaced within a set time period. So if that ever got enforced, that would be a transformational change. If the ISDS new cases could not be filed, that would be a transformational change.
Well, let me bring in at this point, that's Lori Wallach, thank you, director and founder of Public Citizens Global Trade Watch. With that mention of Mexico, let me bring in Laura Carlson, director of the Americas Program of the Center for International Policy. Laura, what can you tell us about the view from Mexico on this? We've got President Nieto negotiating an agreement, which President Obrador would apparently need to okay. You know, how is this looking from Mexico?
Generally speaking, there's been a sigh of relief here in Mexico. What people in Mexico wanted, and particularly the Peña Nieto government, is to just get it over with. The problem for Mexico is that this whole renegotiation and the constant threats of the United States pulling out caused a great deal of instability, particularly in the currency as well as in the financial markets. And so the Mexican government under Peña Nieto, which is not known to be a strong and is certainly not a popular government, basically went the route of having an agenda within NAFTA renegotiations of survival and just making sure that the deal went through. Right now, you're going to talk about the politics of it a little bit. There's a lot of spin, but there's still a long way to go, and there's still a lot of questions. Basically, we have, you know, a Trump press conference in which he just bragged about himself and having reached the deal of the century and the kinds of things that we're used to hearing, and three fact sheets from the USTR that have some information, but they also leave out a lot of gaps. There's still some things that have to be settled within US-Mexico, and then, as Lori mentioned, there's still the whole Canada question. At the beginning, Mexico said they wouldn't go anywhere without Canada, and then they even backed down on that. So what they're calling for as their successes is an end to the sunset clause, which is always a throwaway ask. It was ridiculous. Everyone knew it was ridiculous. They were never really going to insist on it, but they've given this face-saving point to the Mexican government to say, oh, we got rid of the sunset clause.
Which is what?
The sunset clause was what we were mentioning before, that after 5 years there'd be a review, and if there were problems in the agreement, the United States would terminate it instantly. Which, you know, for again, it was a factor of instability and one of the things that both Mexico and Canada disagreed with. And then they also called for, they were asking for a ban on the export from Mexico of fruits and vegetables that were in season in the United States. And they managed to get rid of that as well, which was kind of interesting. I mean, was kind of important to Mexico. But there was no lifting of the steel and aluminum tariffs. The labor part's interesting because there are some potentially very good things for Mexico there. The right to collective bargaining, raising wages, it's something that Mexicans, of course, have been asking for years, and it jives with the new government's, the incoming government's agenda as well. The problem is lack of enforcement, but there's a bigger problem as well. There's a problem that perhaps the Trump administration has not thought this through in the sense that there's a possibility, and business organizations are fearing, that instead of sending jobs back to the United States, which is the aim of the Trump administration, something that would not be particularly beneficial to Mexico, but at least if they were able to raise the lower bar on salaries and basic rights, that would be. But there's a possibility that it could be pushed out of the region. So I think people are watching that very closely as well. So in general, a sigh of relief here. They want to get it over with, but there's a long process. López Obrador, the incoming president, is also saying that they're pleased with this agreement, and in particular, the fact that oil and gas was not included apparently, and he's saying that this is a point in which Mexico has been able to save its national sovereignty.
I know we only have about a minute left of Lori's time, so we'll I'm going to get a last word from Lori and then return back to you. That was Laura Carlson, Director of the Americas Program of the Center for International Policy. Lori Wallach, Director and Founder of Public Citizens Global Trade Watch. I know we've only got about a minute left of your time. Can you give us your bottom line on where things stand now, how you think listeners should view this agreement and what to think about and work towards moving forward with it?
Well, I think despite what would one expect with this administration, some real progress has been made between the U.S. and Mexico on some of the key changes progressives have demanded for decades. But we also know that the enforceability of the new labor standards are lacking, and that has got to be resolved, or the package is not potentially acceptable the gains that have been made, and if the labor standards get to be enforceable, then we'll need to be weighed against whatever is revealed when the final text comes out, could be poison pill provisions. Mm. However, I guess my advice would be, despite what our, again, well-founded instincts would be to assume anything that comes out of this administration, we should fight to the death over, it may be the perverse jiu-jitsu moment where actually some things that progressives have sought for a long time could actually be delivered. And the standard for reviewing this agreement is a different one than, say, progressives have for the TPP, which is to say this is an agreement that's in effect, that for 25 years has been in effect doing damage. It has already resulted in just under a million U.S. jobs being certified just under one narrow program, so it's an undercount, as lost to NAFTA. And more jobs are being outsourced every single week. So just recently, Boeing, Verizon, I mean, these are high-wage, high-tech jobs that are going. And we see every single week workers in Mexico being denied their basic labor rights, being fired if they strike against crap wages that were imposed on them in a contract never voted on. And we see every week more of these investor attacks in these corporate tribunals. So the standard I will judge the final deal on, and I, you know, I urge other people to reserve their judgment until they see what the final is. How I'm going to judge it is, does it stop this ongoing damage? With TPP, the question was, you're going to get a brand new agreement. Do we like what it says? With NAFTA, the question is, you've got a very damaging agreement in place. And does the new proposed agreement stop some of that damage, stop all of that damage? Or is it just more of the same or make it worse? Mm-hmm. But the standard is different because we don't have a blank slate. The position of opposition to this deal means either the status quo, which we know is bad, or, you know, unknown. So the question is this measure potentially going to stop some of the ongoing damage? And okay. I think we need to wait and see.
Okay. Thank you so much. It's Lori Wallach, director and founder of Public Citizens Global Trade Watch. Laura Carlson, director of America's Program of the Center for International Policy. You know, this negotiations over NAFTA are, of course, happening at the same time as a fight over immigration. So will the changes in NAFTA make it so that, you know, this free flow of corporate rights, the free flow of corporations, the free flow of capital, you know, continues on its merry way while people are still stuck and constrained into countries where they are being forced to reside and not allowed to move. How is the discussion over immigration happening in Mexico? And is there a relationship between who's talking about NAFTA renegotiation and immigration policy?
It's worse than even just the relationship that we've always known between free trade and forced migration, because Donald Trump mentioned in his press conference that there was some kind of an agreement that may or may not be formal of Mexico helping us with the border. What that means is that there's always been a rumor that within these NAFTA negotiations, the Mexican government was going to agree to be the migration filter on its own southern border to keep Central Americans in desperate situations, many of them with refugee status, from coming to the United States, including the Safe Third Country Agreement, which would actually make it obligatory for them to ask for refuge in Mexico instead of in the United States. So if that's part of this agreement, that's really bad news for refugees, for human rights, and for Mexico as well. Overall, I would agree with a Scotiabank analysis, which basically says this is a slightly modified deal with a cosmetic change to its name, probably, that allows the White House to sell the revised pact as a significant departure from its predecessor. And then, of course, as Lori says, there's just so much we don't know about the agreement itself. There still has to be Canada brought into it. It's unlikely that they can push it through Congress as a new bilateral. A bilateral would be a terrible deal for Mexico. It breaks the original concept of forming a North American bloc and just goes to the old concept of the United States throwing its weight around through bilateral agreements with weaker countries. But the overall problem for Mexico is that this is the neoliberal model that Andrés Manuel López Obrador said he was going to fight. And there's a number of changes that have to do with redistribution of wealth and a greater role of the state in development here in Mexico that could clash directly with NAFTA.
Mm. Okay, well, unfortunately, we have to stop. I really appreciate you being on with us, Laura Carlson, Director of the Americas Program of the Center for International Policy. So much more to talk about on this subject. Thank you for joining us for the discussion of NAFTA.
Thank you.
We also had with us, Brian.
Lori Wallach, Director and Founder of Public Citizens Global Trade Watch. That takes us just past 7:30 in the morning. The program's up front. My name is Brian Edwards-Teeger. Coming up, a deeper dive on the economic circumstances that give rise to populist social movements, including those inspired by free trade deals like NAFTA. We'll speak to Barry Eichengreen, economist and political scientist at UC Berkeley, about his new book, The Populist Temptation. That's next, after the news.
I'm Max Pringle with these headlines. The preliminary trade deal with Mexico leaves some open questions. Some are wondering if President Trump can reach a replacement NAFTA deal with Mexico alone if Canada can't be coaxed to come aboard. Trump has suggested he might leave Canada out. Future Story News' Kate Fisher has more.
This was originally a trilateral agreement, and at the moment we only have two countries who are signed on to it, the US and Mexico. Mexico making it very clear, the president making it clear that he wants Canada to be part of this deal again, and negotiations will begin on Tuesday morning here in Washington with the Canadian team to try to get that sorted. Donald Trump, he said he's not committed to a trilateral deal, and if he can't get the one he wants, he's happy to make separate bilateral agreements with Mexico and Canada.
That report from Feature Story News' Kate Fisher. Important primaries are being held today in Arizona and Florida. In Arizona, Republicans are running for the seat of retiring Senator Jeff Flake. Flake has been a vocal Trump critic, which could play a role as the state's GOP moves further to the right toward Trump and away from Flake and the late John McCain. The outcome of Tuesday's primary will be closely watched by Arizona Governor Doug Ducey. He must make a replacement Name a replacement, that is, to fill John McCain's seat for the next 2 years. McCain died Saturday of brain cancer. Florida is also holding a primary today, while voters in Oklahoma participate in a runoff for governor. Florida voters are going to the polls to select nominees to replace Republican Governor Rick Scott. President Trump has endorsed U.S. Representative Ron DeSantis in the Republican primary for governor over Agricultural Commissioner Adam Putnam. Former Democratic U.S. Representative Gwen Graham is trying to fend off four challengers as she seeks to become the state's first woman governor. President Trump promised today to address what he says is the very serious situation of social media companies suppressing conservative voices and hiding information and good news. Trump recently has made similar complaints about the issue, which has been making the rounds in conservative media, but today he targeted Google. Asked whether Trump thinks Google should be subject to some regulation, Larry Kudlow, the president's top economic advisor, told reporters only that, quote, "We're taking a look," unquote. The president said in a pre-dawn tweet that included a typo that a search for Trump news on Google shows only the viewing reporting of fake news media. In other words, he says, they have it rigged for me and others, so that almost all stories and news is bad. A report out now shows that nearly a year after California's most destructive set of blazes in state history, only a fraction of nearly 2,700 single-family homes lost in Santa Rosa, the hardest-hit city, have been rebuilt. Santa Rosa City permitting data indicates that only 9 homes have completed construction as of Thursday, and another 520 are under construction. Officials say underinsurance is one of the biggest reasons for delays, as many homeowners discover after disasters that their policies do not cover actual costs of a rebuild, which can delay claim settlements and construction. Partly cloudy today in the San Francisco Bay Area, highs in the 60s and 70s, lows in the 50s, in the central San Joaquin Valley, clear and with highs around 90. I'm Max Pringle. News returns at 8 on KPFA.
You're listening to Upfront. I'm Brian Edwards-Tiegert. One of the incredible paradoxes of our moment is that Donald Trump has maintained shockingly high approval ratings through the worst political scandal since Watergate. And he has largely done this by railing against elites in politics, in the media, and in government. And never mind the fact that he holds the highest political office in the country, got there by virtue of the attention lavished on him by media, and is the actual head of the government that he so frequently rails against. If there is a name for the type of politics he practices, that name is populism. And our next guest has just written a book about it. Barry Eichengreen is professor of economics and political science at UC Berkeley. His latest book, The Populist Temptation, Economic Grievance and Political Reaction in the Modern Era. Thank you for coming in.
Thank you, Brian.
You start with a working definition for us. How are you defining populism?
I define populism as a political movement or tendency with three elements: anti-elite, as you emphasized a moment ago, anti-other or nativist, anti-immigrant, in other words, and third, a movement with authoritarian tendencies. So I think we've seen these kind of movements throughout history where politicians display all three elements. There are, though, populist movements of the left, which emphasize the anti-elite element typically, and populist movements of the right, which emphasize the anti-immigrant or anti-other.
And so the populism of the left would aspire to use the authority of the state against the power of elites, and of the right to deploy the authority of the state against the other, however that's defined.
Yes, so populism, the populist revolt in the United States in the late 19th century, which culminated in the unsuccessful presidential campaign of William Jennings Bryan, who was the candidate of the Democratic Party, but also of the Populist or People's Party, was a campaign of the people against the bankers, against the railroad barons, and against powerful politicians who didn't accommodate or speak to the needs of the common people.
You actually start the clock in your history of populism earlier than that, with the Luddites in England.
And the Luddites, in some sense, were a populist movement as well. I think of populism as being motivated by a combination of economic grievances and identity concerns or identity politics. The economic grievances can be real or imagined, but they revolve around stagnant incomes. They revolve around a sense of inequality. And I think they revolve around, above all, a sense of economic insecurity. So the Luddites, the handloom weavers in England, primarily in southeast England in the early 19th century, were reacting against mechanization and the insecurity they felt about their future economic prospects.
Right. Luddites become a shorthand for someone who's opposed to new technology. But the account you give is people who both face the prospect of losing their livelihoods and also see the economy becoming much more productive, but all the gains from that productivity going to landlords and early capitalists, the owners of those machines. That's a fairly sophisticated political analysis compared to how we think of Luddites today.
The Luddites were concerned about what they saw as a growing economy where the gains were accruing to others rather than themselves. There was also at the same time in England the so-called swing riots, where Small farmers, farm laborers were reacting against the sense that they were losing control over their lives, and in a growing economy, the gains were accruing to others, to large, powerful landlords. Again, I think in the United States at the end of the 19th century, farmers were generally doing okay in the Midwest of the United States, but they saw others doing even better, and they perceived a loss of control over their own fate. So the populist movement in the late 19th century was partly a reaction to high mortgage interest rates and high railroad freight rates that the farmers thought were unfair. It was partly a reaction against the rise of powerful railroad barons and oil magnates like John D. Rockefeller. But it was also a reaction against the commercialization of the economy and the sense on the part of farmers and others that they were no longer in control of their own fate. So I think that is a recurrent theme motivating dissatisfaction with the prevailing political system and with conventional political leaders, that they're not speaking to the economic grievances of the people, but more broadly, that the people are losing control of their own fate. And I think we saw very much the same emotional reaction and political tendency on the part of many of Donald Trump's voters in 2016 and in the Brexit debate in the UK.
Well, let's pick up with the 21st century in a moment. Before we do, I'd like to stay in the 19th century. You ask two recurrent questions with every populist movement that you chronicle in this book. First is, what are the economic conditions that give rise to this movement? And the second is, why did it succeed or fail? So let's start with the Luddites and the populist movement that gave rise to William Jennings Bryan's run at the presidency. Neither of those were successful on their own terms. Why not?
Partly the answer is good luck, that if the economy as a whole begins to do better, it will lift almost all boats. So the British economy began to do better after the 1810s and 1820s. In the United States at the end of the 19th century, there had been a big financial crisis at the beginning of the 1890s, but the economy came out of that, where prices had been falling, and that had been making life tough for the farmers in the United States. There were gold discoveries in the Klondike and Western Australia.
We need to back up and explain that. So there was economic crashes caused by deflationary cycles because the U.S. was on the gold standard. This was one of the principal grievances of farmers who advocated for moving to a silver standard to increase the supply of money. Suddenly there was more gold in the world.
Very well put. So the fortuitous fact, the good luck that there was more gold in the world, began to push up prices. The best book, actually, best recent book on the 1896 election between the populist William Jennings Bryan and the Republican candidate who proved triumphant, William McKinley, was written by none other than Karl Rove, the conservative advisor to Bush II. And Rove credits the fact that the economy began to do better for purely fortuitous reasons for McKinley's victory. So part of the answer is a better performing economy, whether because of good luck or good policies. Part of the answer to whether populist movements fail or succeed is whether the political class does attempt to respond to the perceived grievances of the people. So there were political reforms in Britain starting in the 1830s that did enfranchise, give the vote to more individuals. At the end of the 19th century in the United States, there was the progressive movement that, among other things, established the Interstate Commerce Commission to deal with railroad freight rates and the perceived abuses there. If we go to the 20th century, there was a populist upsurge in the United States in the 1930s. Huey Long was preparing to run for the presidency in 1936, but the fact that the economy began to do better, plus the fact that there was successful effort on the part of the political mainstream in the form of the New Deal to deal with perceived economic insecurity. In response to the problem of insecurity, we got the social security. Right. So whether there is a response on the part of the political mainstream matters importantly as well.
Certainly most historians would count Franklin Delano Roosevelt the single most successful progressive reformer of American history. He did battle with his share of elites, both rhetorically and in the realm of politics, but you do not count him among the ranks of history's populists. Why not? Where do you draw the distinction?
It's hard to think about FDR as a populist. He was certainly a member of the elite coming from Groton.
Fair enough. So is Donald Trump.
Harvard. And from that point of view, I think we have to hesitate before we label Donald Trump a true populist. Is he a true populist, or is he a member of the elite who hangs around with other members of the elite and favors policies that benefit the elite while casting himself as a populist? So I think there is a real question there, but the classic factors, both economic insecurity and identity politics, that breed support for populist politicians certainly bred support for Trump.
So the explanation of Trump's rise to power is still contested terrain for political scientists. And there was an initial hot take that circulated in the media that this was a working class or white working class revolt against political elites. But there's a counter narrative that is fairly well substantiated by the data on who voted how, that racial animus and racial backlash, independent of class identity and class politics, has more explanatory power. That this was a nation with a long and racist history reacting to 8 years of having a black man in the White House.
I'm very strongly of the view that it's not one or the other. If you can be eclectic and strongly of a view at the same time, that this combination of economic grievance and economic insecurity on the one hand with anti-other animosity on the other was what came together and resulted in Trump's election. So different groups define the other in different ways, but if it's predominantly the white working class and middle class that voted for Trump, somewhat less educated than average white middle class and working class, to some extent they defined the other as racial minorities, religious minorities. To some extent, they defined the other as foreigners. It was the same people, after all, less educated than average middle class and working class white voters who felt that economic insecurity. And at the same time, they felt their identity as the dominant group within American society who defined the country's values as under threat by racial, religious, and ethnic minorities.
Let's drill down on the question of economic insecurity, because it's not intuitive. When Donald Trump won election in 2016, it was after 7 years of continual economic growth, dropping unemployment, and at the beginning of an inflection point that saw an increase in real inflation-adjusted wages for the American public. This is not a demagogue running for office in the middle of the Great Depression.
That's exactly right. And that's one of the challenges for people like me who want to argue that economic insecurity played an important role. So I would say two things about your observation. Number one, real wages had stagnated for the average worker, not since the global financial crisis only, but for decades. There was the sense that people were not keeping up And looking forward, the insecurity reflected the perception on the part of parents that their children were not going to be able to achieve the lifestyle that the parents had themselves achieved, owing to changes in the economy. Part of the problem, I think, is the difficulty people have about identifying those changes in the economy and their source. The evidence is strong that the increase in inequality and the stagnation of working class wages reflected primarily the effect of technology that favored skilled workers and disfavored less skilled workers, and only secondarily import competition. It was mainly robots and not China. But Trump was able to play bait and switch, and he was right to recognize that even if the economy was growing, not everyone was benefiting.
He also recognized that there was an elite consensus in American politics in support of advancing free trade deals, often negotiated under circumstances that were completely opaque to the American public, and that nobody with a bully pulpit in American politics was speaking to the downside of those deals.
That's right. The economics profession, of which I'm a card-carrying member, bears blame here. One of the first things we teach our students when we talk about trade deals is that even if the country as a whole benefits, every group need not benefit. That point we were just talking about, and I think to a considerable extent, the experts forgot that important point, and Trump was able to discredit NAFTA and the World Trade Organization and the entire global trading regime, in a sense, by emphasizing that valid point at the expense of everything else.
Speaking of Barry Eichengreen, he's a professor of economics and political science at UC Berkeley. His latest book, The Populist Temptation, Economic Grievance and Political Reaction in the Modern Era. So let me ask you to draw another comparison. A large part of this book dwells on those figures who successfully reformed their governments to blunt populist movements. Otto von Bismarck in Germany, who created the first modern welfare state. Franklin Delano Roosevelt in the midst of the Great Depression. The first president that our 21st century Great Recession ushered into office was Barack Obama. He came in promising to be a reformer, but he did not produce the kind of redistributive reforms that you saw under a Franklin Delano Roosevelt or an Otto von Bismarck or the other examples you have in the book. Do you think that failure of the Obama administration is what made Trump possible?
Yes, I think if Obama had been able to do more in terms of reforming the financial system, he did, after all, put Obamacare in place, which was an important achievement that, despite the best efforts of the Congress and Obama's successor, has not been dismantled.
But rather than blunting populism, that was the fertile ground out of which rose the Tea Party movement, which flipped control of Congress less than a year after the passage of Obamacare.
Still, I think as people learn about Obamacare, they become supporters. Obama's failure to do more reflected two things. Number one, that we were able to stabilize the economy more effectively than we had been in the 1930s. So the urgency of root and branch reform was perceived as less. And number two, we quickly got divided government again after 2009.
So this is your third diagnostic criterion for circumstances under which populist movements prevail, and that is when the apparatus of policymaking is inflexible. in the face of rising populist movements, when you don't have an FDR or an Otto von Bismarck able to radically reform the government, then the regime is apt to be overturned.
That's right. And it's partly a matter of whether that key political leader appears on the scene or not. And it's partly a matter of what kind of political institutions a country has. So one of the questions I ask in the book is whether the United States or Europe is more at risk of populism. My conclusion is that for a variety of reasons, European political institutions, the way leaders are selected, the way elections are conducted, those institutions are more robust and more resilient to capture by populist outsiders than our institutions in the United States, where it's possible for a political candidate like Trump, very much out of the party mainstream, without support from Republican Party leaders, to capture the nomination. And because of the particular electoral institutions we have in the United States, with crazy congressional districts and an electoral college that overrepresents rural voters, it was possible for him to capture the general election as well with a minority of the popular vote.
So you're speaking about two different features of American democracy. One is that our political parties are relatively incoherent and not subject to central control compared to political parties in a parliamentary democracy like you have in Europe. The other is that our system of representation, our formal system for choosing who is in the government, was designed to reflect a status quo that was minority rule in 18th century America. The franchise was limited to white landowning men.
That's right. And that's where the Electoral College comes from, absolutely. I think more generally, I worry about the ability of the American political system, but American society more generally, to meet this populist challenge. Because of that history, Americans have a deep and abiding suspicion, many Americans have a deep and abiding suspicion of government, of central government, of the federal government. And that suspicion, whether they understand it or not, is in good part a legacy of slavery and the Reconstruction period after the Civil War, where Southern states wanted to limit the interference of the federal government in local labor relations and in how the Southern economy was organized. FDR, who we were talking about a moment ago, did achieve a lot with the New Deal, but many New Deal programs had to be administered by the states in order for him to get them passed through the Congress, which enabled Southern politicians to administer unemployment insurance and other programs in ways that benefited certain groups and disfavored others.
Barry Eichengreen, before we close, I wanted to kind of ask you about your position writing this book. This is a book about movements that arise to challenge elites, and you teach political science and economics at one of the most elite universities in the country. You are contributing to the political formation of people who will go on to run our government and our largest businesses. You're not exactly making your argument about populism from neutral ground, are you?
Well, I am making it from UC Berkeley, which you described as an elite institution, but we also have more first-generation American students and Pell Grant recipients than the entire Ivy League. I think, as I said before, the elites bear responsibility for the circumstances that led up to the global financial crisis, for our failure to deal with it better, and for the populist reaction that those failures elicited. Part of the problem was the failure of the elites to communicate what we knew to voters, to the people in plain English.
Yeah. So I guess that circles back to an earlier question I had. The implication is people don't actually know what they want. But isn't it plausible that for the vast majority of Trump's base, they were not voting for an economic program? They were voting because they wanted a loudmouth, destructive, xenophobic racist in office to reflect their own animus back at them?
It's hard to dispute that characterization, but I do think that a better performing economy, better economic policies, compensation for the people left behind by technical change and import competition would have limited that sense of anger toward the political mainstream, toward the parties, toward the elites. And patient voters would have presumably voted for a more patient presidential candidate.